I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our Fall Oncology Nursing Series. As today we talk about the management of prostate cancer, we have a great faculty today, Dr. Mary Ellen Taplin from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Ms. Kathy Burns from the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center in Duarte, California. We're going to talk about two of Kathy's patients that she's taking care of. This is related part of our series that was started in the ONS Congress, and in the end of April, we did 11 symposia there, and we've been doing these break-off follow-up webinars since that time, and we'll be continuing now for another month or so. This is the original program. We had three oncologists and three nurses, including Kathy, presenting cases and talking. And as always, one of our themes in this program and all our nursing programs is, why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient in the same situation, but a different person, different attitude, different background, different social situation? And we'll get into that as we talk about some of the cases here tonight. Also, as always, we'll look to Kathy to not only present the cases, but to talk a little bit about patient education, biopsychosocial considerations, and what we call the bond that heals. The idea that the relationship between the healthcare, the oncology provider, and the patient and family is a very valuable benefit to the patient and family that goes beyond our anti-tumor treatment. We'll look to Mary Ellen to talk about what we call oncology strategy. How does a medical oncologist take the available clinical research information, FDA approvals, their clinical experience, and integrate it into a treatment plan, and how to explain it to patients? Here's broadly where we're heading today. We're going to really try to make rounds. Well, we have a great slide deck for you to look through. We're going to start out, actually, as it turns out, both of our faculty have experience with prostate cancer support groups. So we're going to take advantage of that and begin by chatting a little bit about some of the unique psychosocial aspects of taking care of men with prostate cancer. Then we'll present Kathy's first patient, a man who had metastatic prostate cancer, and we'll talk about the initial therapy, which is what he's getting now, for hormone-sensitive disease. The second case is a patient with more advanced disease and now metastatic disease, but this patient had a BRCA mutation and got a PARP inhibitor. And in between, we'll talk about one of the most exciting developments of all oncology, including prostate cancer, a new agent called lutetium PSMA, not yet approved, probably going to be approved any day now. So this is coming to clinical practice for us to talk about. So just to make this more rounds-like, we really structured the conference today about what we're calling our top 10 list. So the top 10 questions we hear from oncology nurses about prostate cancer, particularly men with advanced disease, and that's going to form the infrastructure of what we're going to talk about here tonight. But I just want to take a breath kind of before we get started. You know, Kathy, when we met a couple months ago to plan for the initial webinar, you mentioned to me that about your experience with the prostate cancer support group. So I want to chat a little bit first about prostate cancer support groups to start with, and then some of the broader issues that relate to all men with prostate cancers. When did you start getting involved with prostate cancer support groups? What are some of the experiences you've had? And I'm also curious how you did it in the era of COVID, or how you are doing it, whether you're integrating any virtual meetings into this and how you're dealing with that. So Kathy, can you comment, please?
All right. Thanks, Neil. I peripherally was involved in prostate cancer support groups in my role. I'm from the East Coast originally. I worked in Hartford, Connecticut, and I was involved in a large cancer program, and we would plan events. But when I moved out to California, that was when that became part of my role, which I was super excited about. This is something that, I find super interesting. I love the collaboration I facilitate it with a social worker for our team, and just the planning and trying to determine what they need. Ours is not the actual typical support group. It's about a third of the year we do the real, like, talking through things, facilitated discussion, networking. A third of the year we focus on supportive medicine and different symptoms. We bring in a different speaker and we facilitate the topics through that speaker. And then a third of the time it's breakthroughs in treatment and things like that. It was always in person. We always had dinner together. You know, we have a large cancer hospital here, but I could always only get about 20, 25 guys with a few significant others sprinkled in. But yeah, COVID hit and we quickly had to make another plan. So it's been virtual on Zoom.
I'm curious how people respond to talking about such deeply personal things on Zoom. Do you think it's pushed people away? Or I could imagine maybe it actually would bring people in who are uncomfortable being in a live situation.
Right, right. It has attracted some people that had not attended before because you don't want to drive in LA traffic 2 hours to get someplace at 6 o'clock. And what I've found is we sort of had a breakthrough this week, actually. It was going to be our annual talk on the latest and greatest in prostate cancer breakthroughs this year. And it's always a very popular topic. And I let them invite anyone they wanted. And our attendance went from 20 to 65. And we had people from all over the country dialing in. And they were very comfortable using the chat and asking questions.
Really interesting.
Worked out great.
Mary Ellen, I'm curious about your experience, but also Kathy mentioned the spouses, and I know a lot of prostate cancer support groups have very active involvement by spouses. I'm curious how it's played out, but also some of your observations about, you know, these therapies are unique in oncology, particularly androgen deprivation, where you remove testosterone. We'll talk later about, you know, some of the side effects, but I think most people are familiar with that. The effects on sexual function and desire. So real issues that kind of tie into relationships. I'm curious kind of what your perception is of sort of how prostate cancer treatment affects relationships between partners and what your experience has been with these groups.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Our group, because of those issues specifically, we divided up into patients with localized prostate cancer who have a lot of concerns about incontinence and erectile dysfunction, and then an advanced group, and then a partners group, specifically for the women or other partners that meet separately. So these groups meet separately, and the magic happens between them. And sometimes I facilitate the women's group, and I really found it valuable over the years. I can give you a few examples if you want. And then we all come together, and it's probably 100 or 200 people, and there's a guest speaker, education. And the patients who attend our prostate cancer group always challenge me with their questions. A lot of these guys have been coming for years and years. Some of them are cured, and they still come because it's important to them. They act as peer mentors, and it's been very, very valuable.
So I'm thinking we've done more than 300 webinars since the pandemic started. I'm thinking maybe we ought to think about doing some webinars for patients and families and provide information, but to be continued in terms of that. Just kind of curious, a couple other thoughts before we move on. Kathy, we were talking about the challenges of androgen deprivation and the issue of sexuality as it relates. And again, with this experience, I'm sure you learn a lot more about that. I'm curious of some of the questions that come up from both the patient and their partner about some of these issues, particularly when going on androgen deprivation. You know, we talked about erectile dysfunction. We talked about the effects in terms of libido. What are some of the questions that come up and some of the common issues that you educate people about?
Yeah, I think there are some commonalities, but on the other hand, we can never judge or assume that a gentleman is going to come in and have sort of a typical reaction to being on ADT. We certainly have a list of things they might experience, but it's across the board how someone kind of internalizes that and manages their responses. So questions, certainly, well, when we talk about support groups, the most vocal about the sexuality, intimacy, prostate cancer issues are usually the significant others. Many of the men have told me that they're not comfortable having those conversations with other men's wives in the room, which I thought was very helpful to us and helped us plan things a little more efficiently. Yeah, I think it's across the board. It's desire. It's can they perform? Will they ever be able to perform? How do things work? It can be a very long conversation.
So I'm sure a lot of these things will come up too as we talk about the patient. But just final comment from you, Mary Ellen, again about this one particular issue. I'm curious how you see couples, sort of adjust to androgen deprivation and again these sexual issues, and also just curious how you guide people into maybe focusing more on intimacy, touching, and the relationship rather than actual, sexual performance. Any comments about your experience in that area?
Yeah, I'll comment on that. And before I do, I'd just like to say it's not only around androgen deprivation. I think the patient with a new diagnosis of prostate cancer that's facing surgery or radiation, they and their partners have a lot of questions, some that are surprising to me, but you can understand why the layperson would be asking these questions, such as, can I give my partner cancer through intercourse? And can I make my cancer worse by sexual relations? And I think a lot of the times we as practitioners forget some really important things about that will affect the sexual function, such as after surgery, radiation can have a normal erection, a normal orgasm, but no fluids will come out. It's like a simple fact of, the mechanics of what's happening with the surgery. But to some patients, it's very disturbing, and we often forget to mention that even. And as far as the androgen deprivation and the effect on sexual function, so we go to great lengths to try to address that with our patient, and it amazes me how individual it is for each patient and each partner. And we have a sexual therapist in our practice that we make available to the patients. And I'm always disappointed at the minority of patients who take us up on those consults. It's almost, I'm not sure what, they're just going to soldier on, and they don't realize that help is out there. But our sexual counselor is very good at getting to where the patient and the couple is, and suggesting, as you mentioned, other avenues to intimacy that aren't around, an injection and ejaculation.
It's interesting how often sometimes somebody will say something and it triggers a memory from long ago that I haven't thought about. And when, Mary Ellen, when you were talking about the idea of newly diagnosed patient, I immediately flipped into something we literally did, I think it was 18 years ago, because we did it just with audio. We didn't even do video. We did a day-long roundtable with 12 physicians, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, and urologists, all of whom had prostate cancer. And I, in particular, remember one doc who was a urologist, Gleason 3+3, who knows whether he even should have been operated on. He, sold all his clothes. He was sure he was going to die. And I'm just kind of curious, Kathy, as, we hear this, too, in all cancer, breast cancer, et cetera. Diagnosis of cancer, doesn't matter what the stage is. Some people immediately assume they're going to die. Is that something you see, Kathy?
Absolutely. Sometimes it takes a while to figure out that we're not talking about the same thing, that we're completely incongruent to each other. And I feel like that's one of the powers of the support group. If you put someone on a new treatment and they walk into the group and they say, I'm so-and-so, I have just started on this and I'm terrified. And, one gentleman at the other end of the table stands up and says, I've been on that for 5 years. That's all they need to hear.
Yeah, really good point. So let's go on and we'll start to talk about some patients here. And Kathy has a 70-year-old man with prostate cancer who actually has metastatic disease. So both lymph node and bone mets. This treatment was started before he got to Kathy. And we're going to talk about some of the questions that relate to this clinical scenario in a second. But this man, can you talk a little bit about sort of I know you met him, he was already started on treatment, Kathy. But sort of a little bit about him as a person as we start to work through how you think through the approach to a man who's never had any kind of hormonal therapy but now has metastatic disease. What was his, what kind of person was he? What was his life situation, Kathy?
Sure. lovely man, married, children, grandchildren. He was still working. He was operating a forklift for a company. So he was driving a forklift in and out of warehouses and things. And he was very, you know, if I asked him what his major goal was, he wanted to keep working. So, you know, I think things like that really come into play when you're thinking about treatment, especially for someone who presents as metastatic. And he was a pretty tough guy. Like, he would come back after a month and he was not a guy that would call and complain. So sometimes he would come in and you'd say, wow, you know, you've really been suffering at home with that or this, but great support.
So let's take a look at a model of prostate cancer to try to sort of see where this fits in. Most men start out on the left there with clinically localized disease. The majority will get picked up on a screening PSA, have a biopsy, have either radiation or surgery and get cured. But a certain number after that will not be cured. And you will see a PSA that's going up, and you can do imaging. You don't see anything other than PSA. And the patient might be treated at that point or may not be. We'll talk in a second about what determines that. If and often it happens, unless they die of something else first, which also happens, they then develop metastatic disease. And then you get into the scenario that this man had, which is metastatic disease and no prior hormonal therapy. We'll talk more about sort of what goes after that. You can see to the right, now you see men who have progression after getting primary therapy. And we'll talk about alternatives, including some new alternatives when we get to that. But first, let's just talk about the first part of this, Mary Ellen, in a patient who's had prior local therapy. You're following their PSA. First of all, maybe you can talk a little bit about a PSA, what it is, how patients and families view it. You know, we hear a lot about some patients who like really get sort of almost obsessed by it. And in particular, how you think through a patient who's had prior surgery or radiation therapy and now they've got this PSA. Maybe you do imaging, you don't see anything. What do you say to the patient in that situation, Mary Ellen? And what are you thinking yourself?
Yep. Well, there's a couple key points to help set the table in your mind for PSA in this setting. So number one, patients will always ask, well, it's not such a good marker. And that's true for screening. But once a patient has had their prostate out or radiation, PSA becomes a very, very good marker. Because once the PSA goes up after surgery, after prostatectomy, there's no other cell in the body that can make PSA. So that is a cancer marker. For radiation, once the PSA goes over 2, then again, that's a cancer marker, and it is very reliable and very valuable. PSA is a protein, and I like to say to my patients who have a lot of PSA focus or anxiety, nobody ever died from PSA. And it oversimplifies it, but I like to get to them to the point where okay, it's a marker, it's a direction for me, up or down, and like whether it's 2 or 2.1 or 3 is not the important part of it. But we do use it as a marker of cancer, and it helps us decide primarily in this setting when we do imaging. Because I try not to make treatment decisions based on a protein in the blood like PSA. I want to know what's happening to the patient's body. Do they have metastasis? Do they not have metastasis? Where in the body are the metastasis located? Maybe another local treatment like focal radiation to a limited metastasis may be an option. So I use PSA after surgery or radiation as a first step to decide if I'm going to do imaging so I can understand where the patient is at in their cancer. And then from there, I will make decisions.
So, you know, the issue here is whether or not to start androgen deprivation to treat just PSA-only disease. We could talk a long time about how people determine that, but basically it's how quickly the PSA is going up, what the level is, and you know, just kind of apply different models to make some predictions. I'm just kind of curious what you see, Kathy, in terms of PSA anxiety in men. I'm sure not all of them have that, but I do hear stories about men who plot it out and all this other stuff. What's your experience with that, and how do you kind of help them cope with the anxiety?
Well, I think one thing is important is we try not to play into their anxiety by, when we see them in clinic and the PSA is down, we don't try and make that absolutely the be all end all. Of course, it's what people want. But if you continue to reinforce that it's so important, they're going to turn it around and say, well, now it's up. What are we going to do? You know, so it's important. You know, I usually say, yeah, there's three things that are important. It's your PSA, it's your images, and it's you. You know, how are you feeling? So I do try and downplay it. And I'm always glad when a patient can tell me, I don't worry about it when I'm home, but when I come in, I'm anxious. And I think that's reasonable.
So Mary Ellen, the first question is about androgen deprivation in this situation or any situation. It was interesting that this man actually is treated with Darogelix, the antagonist. Can you talk a little bit, Mary Ellen, about how these agents work? There's now an oral agent, an oral antagonist, Relugolix, out there that is a consideration. So what are some of the issues that you think about in terms of choosing the type of androgen deprivation? And how does androgen deprivation work? Why do you see PSA drops and, you know, shrinkage of metastatic disease, for example?
Yeah, let me give our audience a little history, ancient history. So probably back in the 1950s, scientists realized that giving patients estrogens, that's what we had at the time, would lead to prostate cancer cells dying. And so we used a lot of estrogen therapy to induce medical castration or orchiectomy, taking the testicles off to induce castration. That work won a Nobel Prize. And then in the 70s, endocrinologists learned how to block the pathway from the pituitary gland to the testicles with drugs that are called LHRH antagonists or agonists. First, we had the agonists. And again, that work won a Nobel Prize and led to patients being able to have medical castration with these common shots that we use now. And as you mentioned, Neil, now recently, just this past year, we have an oral LHRH antagonist, which has pros and cons, which we can get into if you want, the oral versus the shot. But the main idea is that we are lowering a patient's blood level of testosterone because that sends the prostate cancer cells into a programmed cell death. And that's what we want. Unfortunately, the hormone therapy usually isn't curative, but it's very, very effective. More than 90% of men will go into a complete remission, PSA is zero, scans improved, feeling better if they had cancer symptoms. So it's a very effective therapy. And whether it's an antagonist or an agonist, the clinical result is the same. Some of the advantages of an antagonist over an agonist is that you don't get an initial flare or surge of testosterone, which is a temporary thing for 1 to 3 weeks, and it's debatable how negative that flare is, but nevertheless, it's multiple ways to get to the same point: medical castration, prostate cancer cell death.
So, and then a whole, as we talked about, some of the secondary effects before hot flashes and other things. I'm just kind of curious, Kathy, how you see people processing, you know, very important question in the last year and a half, oral, you know, versus parenteral, because you have to come to the clinic, and we've been trying to keep people out of clinic the last year and a half. The other thing about these antagonists is really interesting. I'm not sure anybody completely understands why, is it seems to lower the risk of coronary artery disease, which if you have a patient who already has coronary artery disease, is a particularly important issue. I'm curious, Kathy, how you see people sort of going between oral and parenteral, and whether you see an advantage to any one of these three approaches.
So it depends on the person. I think we first talk financial, you know, that can make a huge difference. Whatever your coverage is, if you have great coverage for on your B plan for injections in the office versus you have a great prescription plan. So I think we start there because that sort of eliminates people, you know, it eliminates their choice sometimes when they're forced with a big financial burden of one or the other. You know, I try to bring in the idea that, you know, lifestyle, right? Staying away from clinic if possible. I also bring up something that I hadn't thought of in the beginning, which is just the mental stress or idea of someone being reminded daily to take a pill. I think that's really important. For some people, it's easy. They take a bunch of pills, one more. But, you know, for a gentleman that might not be taking any pills at all, that reminder of, oh, yeah, I have cancer. I need to take this pill. And then the implications of dropping testosterone. That's a bit of a, I think we need to kind of walk that through sometimes.
So I want to go through a couple of the situations that we now have new approaches to in terms of hormonal therapy. So first, Mary Ellen, sticking with the PSA-only story. So you have a man, his only evidence of disease is a rising PSA. You give him one of these three forms of androgen deprivation. Typically, the PSA is going to come down. Hopefully, it'll become undetectable very commonly. The patient will do well for a long period of time. But assuming they don't die of something else, they may and often do have disease progression in spite of the fact that the androgen deprivation. And up until a few years ago, there wasn't much we could do about that. And then all of a sudden, we saw a number of important clinical trials, and you can check out our slide set if you want to look into the details, looking at using the newer anti-androgens. So, you know, enzalutamide, which has already been out there, but also darolutamide and apalutamide in that situation to add on to the androgen deprivation. And we saw these men generally went back into remission, way better outcomes than if you don't do that. So I guess, you know, one of the questions is, when do you pull the trigger, Mary Ellen? In the trials, they waited until men, or they had men who had doubling times of their PSA that you can calculate over the period of months of more of less than 10 months, which, you know, is a worse prognosis. And then what are the available agents that you can choose from that have been looked at in trials, Mary Ellen? How do you decide which one to use?
So I think it's important to clarify the state of the disease. So when patients haven't had hormone therapy before and they have a rising PSA, let's just say their PSA doubling time is on the short side, because those are the men you want to treat, then we'll start with drugs like Leuprolide and use them intermittently sometimes until they develop resistance. Now let's just say they have resistance to a drug like Leuprolide, but they don't have any metastasis. You've done your scans, so their PSA is rising, but they have no metastasis. It's important to, again, look at the PSA doubling time. And if it's on the short side in the trials, as Neil mentioned, it was 10 months or less, then there's three anti-androgens, enzalutamide, apalutamide, and darolutamide. You can hear that they all sound the same at the end. They are androgen receptor antagonists. They all work equally well. They have a bit of a different side effect profile, which we can go into if we have time. So we will talk to the patient and see what the patient's goals are in terms of pros and cons of using one of these medicines, which have been both shown to delay metastasis and improve survival, but also have the downside of more potential side effects, particularly things like fatigue and hypertension. And we may decide to start one of those medicines. But as Kathy mentioned before, these medicines are very expensive. They come down to about $12,000 a month. So we need to do a prior authorization, see what the copay is. Many of these companies that make these drugs have very nice, actually, patient assistance programs where if the patient meets the need, which are fairly liberal, then they can get the drug for free. So that's kind of the process we go through. Hormone sensitive, no metastasis, castration resistant, no metastasis, and thinking about some of these newer drugs.
And I guess, Kathy, when you think about it, I think basically most people accept the fact that it looks like the benefits, which are huge. I mean, the patients who don't get this therapy have a poor prognosis. They have, you know, metastatic disease in a very short period of time, poor outcomes. The men who do get any one of these three agents do much, much better. They're not cured of disease, but they do much, much better. And they may be functionally cured. They'll live long enough to die of something else, since so many of these patients are older. But there are differences in terms of tolerability, although they haven't necessarily been compared directly, so you can't really be completely sure. You have to kind of look at different ones as kind of figure it out. But Kathy, what are some of the issues that you've seen discussed? I know one big one is what we call fatigue, which now is, seems more like a CNS issue than, you know, fatigue can be a very complex issue. But we've been hearing about that for a while in terms of so-called fatigue, Kathy. What do you see when men get this? And from your point of view, how do you differentiate these drugs based on, can you differentiate them based on toxicity at this point?
I think we have a couple of things that we do tend to consider when we're choosing. One of them, enzalutamide, I think has a little bit more fatigue, and especially the cognitive type fatigue. Abiraterone, which we hadn't talked about, has prednisone, so that sort of changes the selection criteria for maybe someone who's diabetic or can't tolerate prednisone. So there are a few different things that help guide us. At our facilities, we're often deciding things and queuing people up for clinical trials, so that's our thing. But when you're in the community, you know, I often think it's a good idea, especially if you're in general practice. Pick one that you're comfortable with and use it and learn about it. You know, I know that's not often the popular opinion, but
you hear that all the time in oncology. There's like four different approved approaches to first line therapy of renal cell cancer nowadays. And it's like, how do you, they call them identical triplets or whatever. So, but let's again, keep more of the macro perspective in terms of how the patient is experiencing it. Let's move on though and talk about what this man had, which is metastatic disease, but no prior systemic therapy. And there, Mary Ellen, is kind of a different strategy, because you just described, and it makes sense, because like you said, you've got PSA in your blood, so the patient's not symptomatic, you have nothing to palliate, whereas now metastatic disease, if they don't have symptoms, you know symptoms could be right around the corner. And so there in metastatic disease, the way the clinical research evolved was that instead of, you know, first waiting until the patient progressed on androgen deprivation and then bringing in the anti-androgens like we've been talking about, it's like everything goes up front. You just start everything, the androgen deprivation. And interestingly, and this is one of the most interesting decisions in oncology, and one that was really, I think, affected early on by COVID, which is not only do you have hormones, so the anti-androgens, so apalutamide and enzalutamide, darolutamide, not currently been studied or hasn't been approved in this situation. Incidentally, abiraterone's not been studied and approved in the M0 situation. But in the metastatic situation, you have a choice of an anti-androgen to add on. Great benefit that you see with that, enzalutamide or apalutamide. But now you have trials that looked at abiraterone. So Kathy was referring to that before. But you also have trials that look at chemotherapy, 6 cycles of docetaxel. So now you've got the choice between chemo and hormones, and not much evidence that you need both. So you can either kind of get it over in 6 months or so, or take it for a long period of time, different tolerability, et cetera. And then COVID came along, and we were trying to keep everybody out of the infusion rooms, which made it even more complicated. So can you talk a little bit, Mary Ellen, about this really unique, I think, in all of oncology decision that patients have to make with their healthcare providers?
Yeah, it's a hard decision. So the first thing I do is look to see the amount of metastatic disease the patients have, because with limited metastatic disease, say in general 4 metastasis or less, the chemotherapy really didn't have as much benefit as the hormone therapy, whereas the extra hormone therapy, the abiraterone or drugs like enzalutamide, have benefit across all numbers of metastasis. So for the purpose of this example, why don't we say this is a patient with a large burden of metastasis where you do have the choice of which drugs to use. I have the conversation with the patient, and I look at that patient as an individual in terms of age, functional status. Medical comorbidities are very important to look at. Things like diabetes, where maybe the prednisone with the abiraterone might not be great for them, or chronic swelling of their ankles or legs, where docetaxel might not be good for them. And then also their health, a medical copay status, because the chemotherapy infusions will be by and large free to the patients because it's given in the inpatient center, whereas the oral drugs could have a large copay. So I try to weigh these pros and cons with the individual patient. You know, do you want to take pills, which with the abiraterone is four pills once a day, prednisone once a day in the morning, every day, indefinitely until there's progression, which usually is in the two to three or four year range, or six doses of docetaxel, which is done in 4 months. So some patients might prefer not to take pills or have a copay, and you know, we go with the chemotherapy for them.
So just to finish out on this case, and we'll move on to our next case, but just kind of curious, in this man, I know he started out actually on abiraterone with androgen deprivation, and the abiraterone had to be stopped because he had abnormal liver function tests. Then he got put on apalutamide, and I think what happened to him is a good example of how patient education is so important. I know this happened before you were taking care of him, Kathy, but as a lot of people, some people will, one of the side effects of apalutamide can be a rash, which this man got. But what was interesting, and maybe you can relate this to the audience, is I guess how he dealt with the rash, because it's kind of interesting, because I think it probably made the situation worse. He ended up having to stop the therapy. He's off treatment now. But can you just relate what happened with this rash, Kathy?
Yeah, he was the gentleman that didn't really call in and report. So we expected that everything was going well, which is never a good thing, you know. And this was the gentleman that's the forklift driver. So, you know, he used what he had, and he was just scrubbing the heck out of his skin. I can't remember what it was that he was using, like a
coffee
loofah pad.
Coffee ground.
Thank you. We talked about that last time. I had forgot. I couldn't remember. I didn't want to make it up. Good. Yeah. Coffee ground scrubs, thinking he could kind of like slough off the bumps. So when he came in, oh my gosh, looked awful. You know, we work really closely with Derm for lots of things. So we got him on a bunch of things, which I'm sure, you know, it's difficult when he had great support, but you know, you have a gentleman that lives alone and, you know, you almost always get the rash or the itch on your back or somewhere you can't reach. So he wanted to keep on the, you know, despite how it looked, he wanted to stay on the medicine. We gave him a little bit of time on, thinking maybe the creams and the things would help, but we eventually pulled him off. Yeah.
So maybe good to prepare people for this. So let's move on now. I just want to quickly interject something. I know you were both telling me this is number one topic with prostate cancer support groups, because whenever they hear about a new drug, they get excited. We've been hearing about that. We talked about PSMA or PSA, and this is really the therapy is tied into it. We've seen some really encouraging data. It was initially just available in Europe. People would go over to Europe to get it because you couldn't. I think it was at Germany, I think. But it looks like maybe it's coming here. It was actually presented at the ASCO meeting. And in fact, every ASCO meeting, they pick three or four papers as the most important papers in the whole meeting, not just for prostate cancer. This is one of the four that was presented just a couple months ago in June. And Mary Ellen, you actually did the discussion for this paper. What's the bottom line? What do you tell your people in support groups in terms of how this drug works, what we know about it, if and when it does get approved, which seems very likely and like soon, how you think it's going to be integrated into practice, and what are some of the nursing considerations?
I'm excited about it. I like to have a new form of therapy for my patients with advanced disease. And simple language for the patients is it's a form of targeted liquid radiation. So the radiation in this case is radioactive lutetium, is linked to an antibody against a protein on the surface of prostate cancer cells called PSMA, which is different from PSA. It's a different protein, PSMA. And when the radiation is targeted to the cancer cells, it's unlinked from the antibody and absorbed into the cancer cells and can lead to cell death. So it's a treatment that's given intravenously in usually in nuclear medicine departments, but in some smaller hospitals, maybe in radiation oncology departments. And it's given IV every 6 weeks. And in the study, they gave 5 or 6 doses to the patients who were tolerating it and responding. So, so the lutetium-177, there is the radioactive element. And there's a linker there in red to the antibody, PSMA-617. And you can see that it's delivered to the cancer cell. And when it attaches to the membrane of the cancer cell through this antibody, the cancer cell internalizes it. And that's what you see, that term endocytosis there. And then, like any radiation works, it leads to damage of the DNA, in this case, double-stranded breaks, that can lead to the cancer cell dying.
And of course, we saw, particularly in this most recent presentation, we've been looking at curves like this. We always look at that in oncology. This is the chance of staying without recurrence, so better to be on the top line, which is the blue line, which is the treated patients, compared to people who got standard therapy. You can see that the line is different. And also, when you look, we've been talking a lot about hazard ratios in this series, and you see hazard ratio 0.62, and as we've been saying, you subtract that from 100, and what it means is that there's a 38% difference in these two curves at any given point. Your chance of relapse is reduced 38%. So it's not 100%, but it still has a significant effect. What do we know in terms of toxicity and side effects? You would think it's so targeted, you would think it might not have any problems other than the bone marrow. Is that kind of what we see?
Yep. We had about a dozen patients or so on this trial, and actually it was, in my opinion, very well tolerated. We saw some tolerable bone marrow suppression, or occasional blood transfusion requirement, but less than I was expecting. Occasional dry mouth, which was generally low grade, and occasional mild nausea or diarrhea. But in general, easier than chemotherapy, in my opinion.
And here's the so-called waterfall plots that we've also been talking about here. And if you compare the cabazitaxel, the chemo that was the control here, or at least in some of these patients, compared, you can see that the curves, it goes much deeper. Each one of these is a patient, and it's dropping down deeper with this therapy. So to be continued, hopefully this is going to get approved and we'll be able to integrate it. Always great to have a therapy with minimal or no quality of life issues. So we'll see how that plays out. Let's go to our other case in the other clinical situation, because we want to talk about the other, another important, really major advance in prostate cancer, really following the lead that started out with ovarian cancer, where we've talked about PARP inhibitors, now breast cancer. We talked about the fact there's an adjuvant PARP trial that's positive in breast cancer. So adjuvant PARP is now on board in breast cancer. But we also see our PARP inhibitors helpful in not just prostate cancer, but also pancreatic cancer. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, and particularly how men with metastatic disease are managed. This is the patient that we're going to just use this as a basis for. As like many patients with metastatic prostate cancer, he's been on a number of different treatments, including radium-223, another form of radiotherapy that's focused on the bone, but he still had progression after that. And as you can see, he ended up on a PARP inhibitor, rucaparib. So first of all, can you talk a little bit about him as a person, again, Kathy, what his life situation is or was?
Yeah, retired gentleman, married, and kids and grandkids, but not at home. So very tight relationship. Both would be very verbal and communicative together, which is always great.
So, Mary Ellen, as we talk about in the breast cancer programs and ovary programs also, is the question of who can benefit from PARP inhibitors. And we, you know, a lot of times we go through a lot of complex slides, but again, we're just trying to make rounds here today. I'm just kind of curious, first of all, how you explain to patients. You might have a patient who's a physician, for example, or a nurse who doesn't have any experience in oncology, but yet can maybe would be interested in the details. How do you explain the way PARP inhibitors work? and how we figure out who to give it to, which really gets into testing for germline mutations and somatic mutations in the tumor.
Yeah, I usually start by explaining that there are certain mutations in certain genes. And the easiest one to understand, because people have heard of them before, is the BRCA genes. And it turns out that in prostate cancer, BRCA2 is the most commonly mutated of this class of genes. So when there's a mutation in a BRCA gene, whether the patient is born with that and it's in all their cells, including their cancer cells, that would be called a germline mutation. Or whether they don't have a germline mutation, but their cancer cells have mutated over time and the cancer cells themselves have a BRCA mutation, that would be called a somatic mutation. So when the cancer cells have one of these mutations, they have an abnormality in repairing DNA. And when we use a drug like a PARP inhibitor, it gives that process of DNA repair another inhibition or hit that can lead to the death of the cancer cell. So we like to identify patients as having mutations in their germline, either by a blood test or even a saliva test, or by taking a biopsy, a sample of the patient's cancer. It could be a biopsy of the prostate locally or even a metastasis. And those are the patients, and there are other patients in this class of other mutations in this class. But the ones that respond best are the BRCA2 mutations. There are other ATM, CHEK2, POLB2, or others that you might hear of. But that's the concept. And so we like to identify the patients who are most likely to respond by one of these ways, germlines or somatic sequencing.
So, Kathy, I'm just kind of curious, and it kind of reminds me of our discussions on lung cancer, because there you see a lot of somatic mutations in the tumor. So it's not a germline heredity, it's just in the tumor. When you start talking about this to patients, what are some of the things, some of the questions they bring up? I've heard people say, you know, is it going to affect my family? How do you, or the risk of them developing cancer? And we know that if it's somatic mutations, it's not hereditary. But if it is a germline mutation, there are going to be implications of the family. They often will go to a genetic counselor and then make a decision. These are well people in their family, their siblings, or in their family, who are going to maybe find out that they have a mutation that might end up with them wanting to have, you know, if they're a woman, bilateral mastectomy or oophorectomy. What's the discussion like when you start to talk to a patient about doing this type of testing?
Yeah, I think it's complicated and it needs a really good education and assessment of what are they really understanding this? Because it's easy for us to kind of go through the spiel, but I think it really, it takes some kind of visual aids and some written information. I think these are things that they need to think through. We had done a study in kidney patients at one point about, say, genomic testing. And it was a quick interview before, you know, when we gave the spiel. And then it was sort of an interview after. And it was their perception of how great this genomic testing would be for them. And almost 80% of the patients thought it was some sort of a cure. You know, I think we have to be so careful on why, you know, what this means. Because you're absolutely right. It does have so many future implications for them and their loved ones.
Of course, Mary Ellen, we've heard a lot of stories, including in pancreatic cancer, of patients who had incurable metastatic disease, but left as a legacy to their family the fact that they could identify people in the family with germline mutations. They might be prevented from having a cancer again by removing breast and ovary, et cetera. Any comments about your experience with patients when they have germline mutations, how they react to it in terms of trying to decide whether they're going to get their family tested? And how do you explain to patients, again, kind of what's going on? I really love that study that you all did, Kathy. It's great just to ask a patient, you know, what did you understand about what I just told you, for that matter? Any thoughts, Mary Ellen?
Neil, what you just said couldn't be more important. I almost want you to repeat it. So we did a study several years ago when this information was just being introduced into prostate cancer. And, you know, our genetic counselors were going to be overwhelmed with new consults from pancreatic, breast, ovarian, prostate cancer patients, among others. And so we introduced education by video, specifically for prostate patients, and then assessed their education levels and satisfaction with the education. And it changed the whole model of genetic counseling and testing at the Dana-Farber. And we went to a video-based model after this. But when I was putting my prostate cancer patients on the study, I remember one patient in particular. He signed consent, he went for the study, he got the video, he got drawn. And the next time I saw him back in clinic for his next Luprolide shot, his wife and his daughter was with him, and his daughter had already had bilateral mastectomies.
Wow.
Because he had been identified as germline BRCA2. The family was counseled and screened. The daughter had it, and she acted on it right away. And, you know, I can tell you we found Lynch syndrome families from this that then enacted appropriate colon cancer screening. And this is the type of thing that saves lives, and the education around this issue is paramount.
And I think a lot of people were surprised how much we saw when we started. Nobody really thought to look at these men, and it was surprising. You know, we think about breast cancer with BRCA, but just as many men are with prostate cancer. And yeah, we now have two PARP inhibitors that are approved, olaparib and rucaparib, you know, slightly different approvals, but both of them had major trials that looked into using them as monotherapy. In other situations, for example, ovary, it's used as maintenance after chemo. But this was looked at, olaparib was looked at in an important paper. Again, big difference between the men who got olaparib or not. Look at the hazard rate up there, 0.34. That's a major difference in benefit, where survival benefit has also been seen. Rucaparib also has data. You can see the waterfall plots in terms of what's seen with rucaparib. Pretty impressive. Most of the patients, it sort of goes down. Talazoparib is approved in breast cancer, not in prostate cancer, but a lot of work is being done on this and may end up being approved. But all of these have probably more in common, at least that's what we say, than differences. But a key issue is, as always in oncology, what kind of downside are we looking at? And I know, Kathy, of course, you picked a couple cases specifically because they were complications. A lot of men will just sort of cruise through it. This man had a lot of problem with GI toxicity. He actually had to come off it, which is very, very unusual. Mm-hmm. But I'm just curious in general, Kathy, what you see and what you say to a patient who's about to begin a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, I do think in general they're fairly tolerable. And I hate to use that word because then it sort of introduces that there shouldn't be a problem. But, I do think a lot of the symptoms that you get are fairly manageable. And we're actually doing that talazoparib clinical trial, and the guys feel great. But this gentleman in particular with the rucaparib, you're right, he had a lot of GI toxicity, which really resulted in a lot of suffering on his part. He had a lot of nausea, daily vomiting, and just anorexia and weight loss. He had, you know, probably in the time that he was started the medicine and he came off, it was probably 30 or 40 pounds. And wow. They just, you know, it was a daily struggle on what could he eat. It was a really multidisciplinary effort between, you know, supportive medicine and nutrition. But we didn't really have great success in helping him manage them, unfortunately.
So, Marianne, just kind of curious how you think through starting patients on a PARP inhibitor, and particularly how you deal with the issue of potential GI toxicity. I hear some people saying they give patients medications to take or even preemptively, but also what we know about the effects of PARP inhibitors on the bone marrow, both acutely, such as issues such as anemia, something you hear people talking about, but also the potential risk of AML, acute leukemia, and MDS.
Yeah, I actually have a lot of respect for these drugs in terms of, I actually think it's along the line of chemotherapy in terms of the toxicity we see from them. Now, some of that depends on where in the stage of the patient's cancer they're at, and patients with more advanced cancer seem to have more toxicity because their bone marrows are already more suppressed or beat up from prior therapy. But I've had a lot of patients with profound anemia requiring blood transfusions. Usually that state can get better if you just dose reduce them. Say for a olaparib, you go from four pills to three pills, or even two pills a day. So I think the bone marrow side effects are real, and mostly it's around the anemia. While the white count and platelets can be suppressed, they're usually not clinically significant. Chronic nausea is a problem. We generally treat it similar to how we treat nausea related to chemotherapy. Try for sort of lower maintenance drugs first, but followed by, bigger guns, which then can have other complications like constipation if it needs it. But chronic nausea can be a problem.
So, Mary Ellen, in ovarian cancer, PARP inhibitors are now standard as far as upfront treatment of first, newly diagnosed ovarian cancer. As of June, PARP inhibitors are on the menu as adjuvant and post-neoadjuvant therapy in breast cancer. I'm curious, are there trials? Do you see PARP inhibitors moving up into earlier stage? We've been talking about men who present with prostate cancer, metastatic disease, even the M0 situation. Oncology usually is trying to look at things earlier. Is that going on with PARP?
There are trials in metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. Moving it up further, which has really been a dream of mine and others to do it in the right patients, in context of, say, localized early, high-risk localized therapy with surgery or radiation. Those trials have been very, very difficult to get off the ground, primarily because of concern around the screening rate. So in early-stage disease, even high-risk disease, only about 10% of patients will have these mutations, and only half of those are the ones that are likely to respond to PARP therapy, like the BRCA2s. So you have to screen a lot of patients when the hit rate is 10%, So they have not got off the ground, but I think they could be the difference between cure. And we are going to try to, there's two of them that I know of that hopefully are going to get off the ground. But that's the status of it now. We don't have any data for using these drugs earlier than metastatic castration-resistant disease, usually post-chemo or at least post-abiraterone or enzalutamide.